established. And today we're going to have an informational hearing regarding the interplay between the Office of Inspector General and the DHS Commissioner. And we are going to be hearing particularly going through questions we've had for a few months now on Medicaid eligibility rules and how you're managing verification of eligibility for enrollees and providers and some of the payment issues we've seen in Medicaid. So that's the scope of today's hearing. We do have minutes from our May 5th meeting, but we are not going to approve them today, committee members. There's been some discussion with staff of whether when we're out of session, that's the right approach. So we will take that up with council and decide at the next hearing whether we're going to approve minutes. So we'll dispense with that for today. So before we get started, members, I just wanted to take a moment. I know this is the first official meeting of anybody since the horrific assassinations of Speaker Hortman and her husband, Mark, and the release of the attempted assassinations of Senator Huffman and his wife. And we just want to acknowledge that is still a process we are all dealing with and grieving, and we continue to pray for the Hortman family. And Senator Huffman, delighted to see that he was released to rehab yesterday. And, you know, we just are thrilled about that. And we will continue to pray for he and Yvette's complete recovery. But certainly it's important for us as a body to show the public that the work of the legislature continues. And I do think Speaker Hortman was a very practical person focused on the institution of the legislature, and I think that we are honoring her by continuing our work. And I know Chair Pinto would like to say a few words as well.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thanks so much for those remarks. And one thing I want to make sure to say publicly is a big thanks to the people of Minnesota for their support and the messages of just of love to so many of us. Seeing people at the vigil on that Wednesday after the assassinations, and then when they were lying in state on that that following Friday, that provided a measure of healing and support. And I mean, I've had a lot of weeping over those couple weeks, and those events in particular. It was just really powerful, and so really want to say thank you to folks for that support for all of us. We're thinking about Melissa and Mark, and just so grateful for the leadership she provided in this body. I'm thinking especially today about for her, and I get this from my colleague Representative Reeman, that the work that we do here is really about people and the impact on people. And I feel like she pushed us so often to be thinking in those terms. It actually feels appropriate to me that we're having this hearing at this time. In Medicaid, which is a focus that we're going to be talking about today, is so much about the impact on people, making sure that they have the health care that they need to lead successful lives. And so I'm really grateful to the public servants who work to make sure that program is available for those who need it. It's a program that is in a lot of our minds right now. And I'm sure we'll talk about this throughout the hearing, but there's been recent action in Congress that we know is going to take a lot of people off the program. And so eligibility determinations are going to be especially important. We want to make sure they wouldn't in any way prevent people from being able to access these services. And as I say, that impact on people, I guess I'm going to have that continue to be uppermost in my mind, both this hearing and this upcoming session. And I hope and would imagine that all of us will have that as well. And so thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you. And before we get started, I just want to kind of remind the public how we got here today. So we had originally scheduled a May 5th hearing with DHS to talk about Medicaid eligibility. And just due to end of session budget negotiations, they requested a delay, which we were happy to accommodate. And then we rescheduled for June 24th. Because the intention of this committee is to meet monthly during the interim, but then due to the horrific assassinations, we again delayed, and now we are back. So this hearing has been months in the making. We have been trying to get a handle on just sort of a level set for us as committee members and the public about the work of the Office of Inspector General and the work of DHS and how we verify Medicaid eligibility. So with that, I'll turn it over to Acting Commissioner Shireen Gandhi and her team. And I know you'd outlined two different presentations. Let's just try to run through both of them, and then we'll have more of a wide-ranging discussion at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm serving as temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Before we begin today, I just want to also share my condolences with all of you and your staff for the political violence that unfolded just 3 weeks ago. It's hard to believe. The assassination of Speaker Emerita Hortman and her husband Mark, and the attempted assassination of Senator Hoffman and Yvette are just heartbreaking. We're heartbroken over it. We're angry, and we just want to acknowledge that many of us are still reeling from those events as well. So getting, as you said, Chair Robbins, getting at the task at hand today, I want to start off by thanking you. We are grateful for the legislature's focus on preventing and detecting fraud last session. Most of the provisions that were in the governor's budget in the fraud package were supported by the legislature, including many of you. We also enjoyed collaborating on program integrity measures that were not included in the governor's budget, but also support program integrity. In particular, we worked closely with Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, Chairs Schumacher and Noor, Chairs Backer and Bierman, Representatives Norris and Anderson, and Judiciary and Public Safety Chairs and members on those committees. Our Minnesota Medicaid programs help more than 1 million people access the care they need. Medical care, therapy, treatment, housing, and other services that allow people to stay healthy and to contribute to the economy. We know that fraud hurts the people who need these services. Program integrity work is a high priority for DHS and the Walls-Flanagan administration. So I thank you for your partnership on this. The committee's focus on fraud oversight led to many important reforms in the governor's budget being enacted this last session. This isn't an exhaustive list, but I'll name a few reforms to celebrate and recognize our collective efforts. Prohibition on illegal remunerations, also known as kickbacks, for medical assistance, which is Medicaid, what we call Medicaid in Minnesota, and child care assistance programs. Prohibition on duplicative billing. Provider compliance training required prior to enrollment for unlicensed services. The authority to share data, including claims data, with state and federal agencies to investigate suspected fraud. The authority for DHS to disclose payment withholds. The authority for DHS to deny licensure applications or temporarily suspend a license for individuals that are the current subject of a pending administrative, civil, or criminal investigation. And then more specifically, for autism services, which are known as early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention, a new provisional license was enacted for EIDBI. It's a short-term step that bridges us allows us to increase oversight until robust licensing standards are developed with community input. EID providers will be required to revalidate their Medicaid enrollment every 3 years instead of every 5 years. DHS will have the authority to investigate maltreatment allegations in EIDBI. We will have tightened standards for EIDBI to ensure a background study is completed before an individual is allowed to start work. It's added staff to DHS to manage the additional eligibility and compliance checks that will be coming, allowing for a higher volume of on-site screenings and background studies, and improved oversight of clinical requirements to ensure high-quality service, provider retention, and better outcomes for children and families. For the Housing Stabilization Services Program, legislative changes enacted include billing unit limits, capping billing at 100 hours annually per client, limits on remote support to no more than 20% of all housing transition services, required compliance training. Before enrolling, enrollers and managers involved in day-to-day operations are required to complete training on a number of items, including state and federal billing, documentation and service delivery requirements, enrollment requirements, program integrity, including fraud prevention, detection, and penalties, fair labor standards, workplace safety requirements, and recent changes in service requirements. It also added additional funding for more site visits. Providers will get a pre-enrollment visit, as well as unannounced site visits. We are also conducting pre-enrollment risk assessments for all new and renewing providers as part of confirming provider eligibility. That was effective July 1st, and our pre-enrollment risk assessment, which we call PARA for short, in case I use that acronym, will cover the provider's history of performing similar services, whether enrollment would require the provider to perform at a significantly increased scale, and if so, that they have the capacity to do that, the provider's financial information and internal controls, compliance with other state and federal requirements, including debarment and suspension status, and their standing with the Secretary of State. Increased documentation requirements, recipients of the services must sign that they received the hours that were billed. And lastly, surety bonds. Providers must show proof of surety bond, which helps guarantee performance by the provider, or the state will be compensated and the surety seeks repayment from the provider. So with me today is DHS's Inspector General James Clark. He joined DHS at the end of March and brings a wealth of experience prosecuting fraud in human services programs. I feel fortunate that we found somebody that knows both DHS and the Medicaid program. He comes to us from the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Division. James not only knows DHS programs, he has taken down fraudsters and has strong partnerships with law enforcement. As an assistant attorney general, he investigated and prosecuted criminal and civil cases involving the theft of Medicaid funds, the False Claims Act violations, and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. He has wide experience managing complex financial investigations of nearly every type of Medicaid fraud. As Assistant Attorney General, James also represented DHS in state and federal courts and for administrative hearings, giving him a broad understanding of DHS. And beyond this, Inspector General Clark understands how critical human services are to the people of Minnesota, having worked for legal aid after graduating law school. I am grateful that Inspector General Clark's professional path brought him to DHS, and he has immediately put his considerable talents to work for our Office of Inspector General. Chair Robbins, I'd like to have Inspector General Clark introduce himself and provide more information on DHS's Inspector General Office.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Inspector General Clark. Please just start with saying your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. James Clark. I'm the new Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. So I first want to thank the committee for having me this morning. As you know, I'm just introduced myself, James Clark. I'm the new Inspector General at DHS as of March. Prior to this role, as the commissioner said, I worked at the Attorney General's office for close to a decade. I've investigated and prosecuted doctors, nurses, dentists, therapists, business owners, billers, all for Medicaid fraud from all different and business owners of all different Medicaid provider types. I've sent people to prison for stealing Medicaid dollars, and I've helped to secure several millions of dollars in monetary recovery for our state. I take this work extremely seriously, and I also care deeply about the people that Medicaid and other public benefit programs are designed to help. As the commissioner said, after law school, I worked for several years at Legal Aid in Minneapolis, where I represented people who depended on Medicaid and other public benefit programs for their family's health and safety. I had many clients that I remember vividly crying in my office at the prospect of losing their public benefits. This work is critically important to the people of our state, and that's why I'm passionate about it. The fact that people decide to steal from taxpayer-funded programs that are designed to help people in need is reprehensible. Personally, I find it disgusting. It's also illegal, but I think most importantly, it's also immoral. It harms taxpayers, but also harms the very people that these programs are designed to help. I know the schemes that providers are engaging in because I spent years investigating and prosecuting them. A part of why I came to DHS from the Attorney General's Office Medicaid Fraud Division was to share my knowledge of Medicaid fraud schemes and help strengthen the ongoing work that DHS is doing in administrative oversight on the front end. Unfortunately, we all know Medicaid is on the chopping block. People in Minnesota, around the country, are at risk of losing their health care. I think right now we need to be more vigilant than ever to ensure that we are safeguarding Medicaid dollars and they are not being stolen from us. I will do everything I can in this role to detect and prevent fraud and hold bad actors accountable, continuing the work that I did at the Medicaid Fraud Division at the Attorney General's office, and I look forward to working with all of you on these important issues. So I do have a few slides that have some high-level information about OIG functions. So I want to start by giving some background about the work of the Inspector General's office. So the Inspector General's office has three core program integrity functions. As the slide shows, background studies, we call them background studies. Most people refer to them as background checks, licensing of providers, and then provider investigations. So our fight against fraud and overbilling starts at the front end with vetting and educating providers. Background studies prevent bad actors from gaining access to children, vulnerable adults, and Medicaid dollars. The Background Studies Division at the Office of Inspector General conducts over 500,000 background studies on entities and individuals each year and determines whether there is criminal conduct or other disqualifying information that prohibits someone from gaining access to Medicaid recipients or Medicaid dollars. So that's where we start on the front end, vetting providers, making sure they don't have disqualifying criminal conduct. Moving on to the Licensing Division. The Licensing Division vets provider applications and conducts inspections to ensure that licensed programs, such as substance use disorder providers and home and community-based service providers, comply with required statutes and rules. That often involves site visits to providers, reviewing records, interviewing recipients that receive services at those programs to make sure that maltreatment is not occurring and make sure that the law is being followed at licensed programs. Finally, a core function of the Office of Inspector General is provider investigations. The Office of Inspector General is responsible for overseeing close to 300,000 Medicaid providers in the state of Minnesota. We currently have 988, so close to 1,000 open cases that we are investigating. It's important to note that not all cases and investigations result in findings of fraud, right? Oftentimes there's administrative errors that we're investigating. There's overbilling issues that may not have been the result of fraud, so mistakes, but nevertheless we are investigating all of those cases, nearly 1,000, to make sure that we are identifying any problematic billing practices and recovering any money that the state is entitled to. It is important to note that DHS is not responsible for investigating Medicaid recipient fraud. Each of the 87 counties in Minnesota is responsible for enrolling and detecting potential recipient fraud, right? So when we're thinking about investigations at the Department of Human Services, we are solely investigating Medicaid providers. Well, we do some Minnesota care investigations, but not Medicaid recipient investigations. I will also want to stress that DHS OIG is not a law enforcement or prosecuting agency. Our role is providing administrative oversight. However, we work closely with law enforcement partners at the local, state, and federal levels to develop strong cases they can take to court. One of the reasons I came over to the Department of Human Services is to further strengthen the partnerships between OIG and the Attorney General's Office, also our partners with HHS OIG, the FBI, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. In my short time here, I've had several meetings and briefings with our federal law enforcement partners on fraud schemes and providers that we are looking at OIG. I think it's also important to note that the vast majority of cases prosecuted in our state originated as referrals from the Department of Human Services. But referring a case to law enforcement does not end the Department of Human Services' work. After a referral is made, DHS also plays a critical role throughout the life of a prosecution. Speaking from experience at trials and hearings at the Attorney General's office, really our work depended on the data, the documents, and the witnesses at trial from the Department of Human Services. No Medicaid fraud investigation or prosecution can be successful in the state without the work of Department of Human Services employees. I next want to talk about Office of Inspector General collaboration. As I said earlier, we currently oversee close to 300,000 Medicaid providers. In my short time at DHS, I've seen it's very important to be able to collaborate closely with DHS policy areas. Medicaid rules and statutes, as you all know, can be complicated. They are lengthy. So when OIG staff investigates providers, we rely on the administrative expertise of DHS policy staff who know the rules and requirements of these programs most intimately. Working closely with DHS policy staff also gives the Office of Inspector General the ability to share our hands-on knowledge about fraud schemes and overbilling schemes we're seeing, to work with the policy teams to develop policy and statutory revisions that can strengthen compliance, accountability, and enforcement. This collaborative approach helps ensure that the Office of Inspector General and policy areas maintain a unified strategy for protecting taxpayer dollars. So in my 3 months here, we are frequently in communication with DHS policy areas, thinking about ways that we can strengthen program integrity across DHS programs. Next slide, please. I next want to highlight the fact that the Office of Inspector General uses data to proactively detect and prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. We have our own in-house data team, our data analytics division, that monitors Medicaid billing data to identify problematic billing patterns and billing outliers that we can then review that data to identify investigative targets. So we have our own in-house data team that's proactively monitoring our billing information and informing our next investigative steps. It's also important to point out that the Office of Inspector General partners with private sector vendors to detect and prevent fraud, waste, and abuse. We work with the CMS, so the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Studies or Services, mandated federal contractor. We work with that contractor called the UPIC is the acronym, the Unified Program Integrity Contractor. So each state Medicaid agency is required to have a CMS contractor working with them. So that contractor proactively reviews our billing data to detect fraud, waste, and abuse, prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, and also identify program vulnerabilities and room for improvements. We also work with a private sector contractor to conduct audits of providers and recover overpayments. So DHS is doing that work in-house, but we also leverage the experience of the private sector to help us with reviewing billing data and conducting audits of providers and recovering overpayments. The last thing I'd note is that Minnesota is a 90% managed care state. So we heavily rely on the proactive investigative work of our managed care partners, such as UCare, Medica, Blue Cross, and Health Partners, who are responsible for fraud detection and prevention and the 90% of Medicaid dollars that funnel to them. So each of the MCOs that we contract with, they all have investigative units. They call them special investigative units who are responsible for detecting and preventing fraud, right? So internally, DHS is doing a lot of work. We also work with private contractors, and we also rely on the private sectors, our private healthcare companies here in Minnesota, to prevent and detect fraud of the Medicaid dollars that they receive. Next, I'll briefly walk through this flow chart slide. So the slide contains a flow chart outlining the process for handling provider complaints at the Office of Inspector General. Again, we review all complaints, tips, or information shared with us. Tips can be submitted online through the DHS website, by phone, by email, in person. We will take tips from any source who wants to come forward with complaints about Medicaid providers. We have a zero tolerance policy for fraud, waste, and abuse, and we take every complaint seriously and track all of them in our centralized computer system. So first, intake staff will review the complaint. If the complaint is not regarding a provider who bills DHS programs, we will reroute the complaint to the appropriate area. Maybe it's a county issue. Maybe it's a different state agency issue. For example, we get complaints about healthcare providers who don't participate in the Medicaid program, but they might be licensed by the Department of Health. So we would refer those complaints to the Department of Health. Sometimes our office will need to reach out to the reporter to gather additional information or clarification. So for instance, names, addresses, more information about the provider, dates and times. So we'll do that. We'll gather information to get clarification. When all necessary information is gathered, a preliminary investigation will occur. A preliminary investigation is really just a very high-level overview of the information we can gather from the complaint. So really, is the provider actively billing us? And is the recipient who maybe made the complaint or the recipient that's involved with the complaint, are they actively receiving services from that provider? So if a complaint concerns a Medicaid provider that is actively billing us and there are allegations of improper billing, we will open up a full investigation. Our investigations involve reviewing documents, doing on-site visits, doing interviews, looking at bank records, looking at billing records, really looking at all of the information we can get our hands on. And the finding of that full investigation will determine the Office of Inspector General's next steps. Those steps can include, in cases of where we see evidence of fraud, referrals to the Attorney General's office or the FBI or other federal law enforcement partners. Again, you know, if we don't see allegations that rise to the level of fraud, we can take administrative action such as a termination of a provider. We can suspend a provider from participating in the Medicaid program. We can suspend them from receiving payments during an investigation when we see fraud. And at the end of investigations, we can take them to court at the Office of Administrative Hearings to recover overpayments. Just like to point out that the case that I last charged before coming over here at the Attorney General's office was a pretty large racketeering case involving a Medicaid provider, a personal care agency. And that case, right, that I charged worked its way through this process, right? So it started as a complaint, a Medicaid recipient calling DHS saying, hey, look, I'm not getting the care that I'm supposed to. I think something's wrong with this company. DHS investigated that complaint through this process here. DHS stopped payments to the providers. DHS referred to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office expanded the scope of that investigation and ultimately charged a very large racketeering case for that provider. So that's all I have in terms of slides. Again, that's a very high-level overview of the work we do, and I'll give it back to the commissioner.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, members of the committee. The committee also asked us to provide information on Medicaid eligibility and oversight of the program, so our remaining slides will cover this request. Federal law establishes the minimum eligibility requirements for individuals to qualify for Medicaid. There are many factors that impact Medicaid eligibility, including citizenship, immigration status, state residency, income, and assets for some. In Minnesota, counties make individual medical assistance eligibility determinations, as Inspector General Clark noted, and oversee alleged recipient fraud. To be eligible for medical assistance, applicants must be a citizen, be a U.S. citizen, or have a Medicaid-qualified immigration status, reside in Minnesota, making Minnesota their home, provide their Social Security number as a condition of eligibility unless they meet certain exceptions, generally, a person's income must be less than or equal to the appropriate income limit. Income limits vary based on a person's basis of eligibility. So, for example, a child, a pregnant woman, a parent, adult without children, seniors, or people with disabilities. Income limits are based on federal poverty guidelines and are updated annually. There is an asset limit for people who are 65 or older and people who are disabled. Assets are counted including checking accounts, savings accounts, money market accounts, certificates of deposit, certain trusts, non-homestead real property, certain vehicles, and other items of value. The asset limits are $3,000 for a household of one, $6,000 for a household of two, and $200 for each additional household member. There are no asset limits for children, pregnant women, parents, or adults without children as specified by federal law. There are other program rules. So, for example, to qualify for MA as a parent, you must live with your child who is under age 19. Eligibility determinations are made by the counties and tribal workers with system support from DHS. A renewal is a review of income and other information to see if individuals and other family members are still eligible for medical assistance. Generally, this happens once every year. At renewal, Medicaid agencies are required to first check electronic data sources to see if they can automatically renew an individual's eligibility before requesting additional documentation. The use of these electronic data sources helps improve the accuracy of eligibility determination, reduces the workload for county and tribal eligibility staff, and reduces the reporting burden for MA enrollees. If eligibility is confirmed using these trusted data sources, the individual is mailed a notice and information summary to review for accuracy. If the information is accurate, the individual does not need to do anything. If the information is not accurate, they must report any changes or corrections to their county or tribal processing agency. If eligibility cannot be confirmed, a renewal form is mailed to the individual to complete, sign, and return with the required proofs. For example, income and assets if the individual is subject to an asset limit. If they fail to return the form, then that will result in the loss of eligibility and their case is closed. And they are mailed a 10-day advance closing notice. In addition, between the annual eligibility renewals, there is data matching with trusted data sources to identify individuals who may no longer qualify due to income or death. These individuals are sent a discrepancy notice and must respond by completing and returning the form or contacting their processing agency. If they fail to respond, their eligibility closes. If they respond, their eligibility is redetermined to see if they remain eligible. Want to share the data sources that we use. Medicaid eligibility determinations involve the use of a number of trusted federal and state data sources. You can see many of them listed here on the slide. They corroborate the information provided by the individual at application and annual renewal. The data that we use includes data from the Social Security Administration to verify Social Security numbers, SSA benefits, and U.S. citizenship, and identify deaths. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is used to verify immigration status. The Internal Revenue Service is used to verify income and self-employment. Equifax, also known as the work number, is used to verify wages. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development is used to verify wages and unemployment benefits. The asset verification service is used to verify certain financial accounts, such as checking, savings, and CDs, and identify unreported financial accounts for those that are subject to an asset limit. And the Minnesota Department of Health state death records are used to identify enrollees who have passed away and end their eligibility. So the committee also asked us about the COVID-19 pandemic. At that time, all states were required to maintain health care coverage for Medicaid enrollees. This paused regular eligibility checks and renewals. Minnesotans who newly gained eligibility or already had eligibility for medical assistance or Minnesota Care remained enrolled in the coverage regardless of most changes in their lives that previously would have affected their coverage. Continuous coverage helped Minnesotans access care during the global pandemic and maintained high insurance coverage rates in the state. In the spring of 2023, Congress passed legislation requiring states to return to standard Medicaid eligibility procedures, which included an annual eligibility review. This meant, as of March 31st, 2023, the continuous enrollment provision ended. The process of renewing all recipients was completed in June of 2024, which was a very heavy lift for the counties and the state. And for the past year, regular annual renewals have been taking place. Turning back to program integrity, DHS is currently in the process of implementing laws enacted by the 2025 legislature. Paramount to this work is ensuring that the laws are implemented according to the letter of the law and as intended. DHS looks forward to ongoing collaboration with partners to implement what was passed. There are many steps to implementation. We have to communicate. Some of you may have seen emails from DHS on new laws or heard an end of session presentation. It's important that DHS communicates new requirements with providers, community, update fact sheets, provider manuals, hold meetings with various partners and constituents, including counties, provider associations, tribal nations, advocates, and healthcare systems. We also have to collaborate across DHS program areas to implement Medicaid changes. This requires updates to the Federal Register, member notices, provider notices, managed care contract amendments, and federal approval. In some cases, DHS needs to submit amendments or waivers to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services seeking federal approval. As part of this process, DHS must post changes for public comment and work over the course of approximately 3 to 6 months to get approval. We also have to update systems, as we've talked about in this committee previously, which is a critical component of implementation. We partner with Minit on that work as well as external vendors. So while we are in the midst of managing this important work of implementing state changes, the federal budget reconciliation bill was just signed into law on July 4th. DHS is still assessing the fiscal and enrollment impact of the bill on Minnesota healthcare programs, but estimates are that it cuts roughly $500 million in annual funding to Minnesota, while increasing costs and red tape for counties, hospitals, and enrollees. The Association for Minnesota Counties estimates that the requirements in this bill will double and possibly triple the administrative workload to counties. Counties have shared that even with the recent funding, Minnesota's outdated systems, some of those are ones that we've talked about in various committees, SSIS, MAXIS, METS, will make it very challenging to implement this bill. They are assessing the specific cost to the state for systems upgrades as they plan for the 2026 legislative session. And the most recent projection from the Kaiser Family Foundation for the Reconciliation Bill estimates that between 150,000 and 250,000 Medicaid enrollees in Minnesota will lose coverage because of the bill. People with disabilities, older adults, people with mental health conditions, rural hospitals, and nursing homes are likely to be the hardest hit by a weakened state Medicaid program. It's important to keep in mind that impacts on Minnesotans who rely on Medicaid, Minnesota providers, and Minnesota's taxpayers are cumulative and interactive. Among the many provisions, the bill implements work reporting requirements, six-month eligibility checks, and cost sharing for adults in the expansion group, reduces retroactive coverage, which means MA applications need to be submitted quickly to ensure people have the coverage they need for their bills to be paid to providers. This puts additional pressures on navigators, hospitals, and counties, and others who assist people in filing their applications for MA. It prohibits federal Medicaid funding for some family planning clinics, eliminating a critical access point for reproductive health care services, and implements tougher restrictions on state-directed payments and provider taxes, which present an obstacle to implementing hundreds of millions of dollars in rate increases for hospitals, basic care providers, and behavioral health providers throughout the state. So in short, while we are working to implement the strong program integrity measures that this legislature passed, we are also juggling these significant changes, federal changes that are costly to Minnesota.
Great. Thank you very much. I just was checking. We had a testifier sign up to testify virtually, but she hasn't appeared yet. So I think we'll move on to member questions and then interrupt ourselves if she does join us. And also following up on that, we did, during the discussion, learn that we can approve minutes during the interim. And so with that, Vice Chair Anderson, I wonder if you would be willing to move the minutes from May 5th.
Move the minutes from May 5th. Thank you.
Great. The minutes are in your packets. Does anyone have any questions? All those in favor of approving the minutes from May 5th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are accepted. All right. Now we will go on to member questions. I have a list, and there will be a lot. So we look forward to this discussion with you all. Thank you for your testimony. Let's start with Chair Rarick. I have so many. I need to get my own thoughts together. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here and being back so many times. Commissioner Gandhi, I appreciate that. And it's great to have the new Inspector General. That's fantastic. So I just wanted to get a better understanding of the Inspector General's office within DHS. And it's interesting that he would work for the Attorney General, because we had Keith Ellison, Attorney General, in. And when we were talking with Attorney General Ellison, he had mentioned that they oversee $20 billion a year in Medicaid money. And I'm just wondering if you, I've got a few questions around that, and maybe you can verify that, if that's accurate, with money that kind of flows through DHS and some things that they're responsible for in, because they're all the fraud they're responsible for in Medicaid, the Medicaid area. So the question is it $20 billion annually of money that flows through for Medicaid? And secondly, I also, at that time when he was here, we talked about the misappropriations or incorrect payments or fraud or whatever category you want to put it in. We talked about that briefly, but at that time, I had kind of thought about the number of 1.5%, because that was a really, really low misappropriation rate from DEED when we had all of the money going through from COVID money. But since then, a federal number has come out with this big bill that was just passed, and it was 5.06% of an inappropriate payment rate. And when I do that number, instead of it being, say, $200 million a year of fraud or misappropriations, it's $1 billion. So I'm wondering, because you didn't give us any of that high-level information, can you first tell us how much flows through DHS for Medicaid? Secondly, what is your fraud rate? Is it 1%? Is it 2? Is it 3? Is it 4? Is it 5? Is it higher than that? Because that's just a federal average for Medicaid. Thirdly, I want to know, you said you had about 1,000 cases right now, approximately 1,000 cases. And if I recall, in previous testimony, you had 491, or just shy of 500 employees at the Inspector General office. So can you tell us how many employees that you have and how many of those employees are working on the cases? Because if you had, say, almost 500 employees and only 1,000 cases, that's only 2 cases per investigator, which seems kind of low. But I'm assuming that you have other folks doing other things. But can you kind of do a breakdown? So hopefully you got all those questions, and sure. I did it that way so that we can move quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Commissioner Gandhi or Inspector General Clark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Rarick. So there was a lot to unpack there, so I will try my best. So I believe that figure, $20 billion, I believe that's the total amount of Medicaid spending in the state of Minnesota, right? So when the Attorney General's office is saying our Medicaid fraud division is responsible for overseeing $20 billion, I think that's what he's saying, right? And we know not all $20 billion is being stolen to fraud, but there is a percentage that is. Hence, we have prosecutors that prosecute those cases where there is fraud. So I think that $20 billion is correct or close to correct. I think it varies from year to year. Looks like the commissioner is shaking her head, right? So $20 billion, the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Division is responsible for overseeing. The scary thing is they only have about 6 or 7 prosecutors, right? So when you think about the amount of resources that would be needed, right, to really oversee a $20 billion program, we have to think about whether or not the Attorney General's office has the amount of resources it needs and also whether DHS OIG has the amount of resources it needs. $20 billion is a lot for us to be in charge of and safeguard. The second part of your question was about improper payment rates. I've seen that figure where CMS is estimating nationwide it's about a 5% improper payment rate. The most recent figure I saw, and I kind of anticipated this question because I saw it posed of my former boss, Nick Wonka, from the Medicaid Fraud Division when he was here to testify. So I did some digging, thankfully, with some of our folks at DHS. And so the most recent statistic I was able to find was a CMS study from 2022, which says that Minnesota's improper payment rates are actually less than that national average. So I've seen a 2.2% rate of improper payments in Minnesota. So this was in 2022. I was preparing on the fly here. Again, I'm new at DHS, been here about 3 months. But at least CMS said, as of 3 years ago, we were better than the national average in improper payment rates. And also, it's important to note, improper payments does not mean fraud, right? There's a lot of administrative error, a lot of, you know, documentation issues, not everything that we investigate. So getting to the 1,000 cases, right, I think I wish I had the percentage. I don't. Again, I'm new here. I can get that information for you. But it's a small percentage of that 1,000 that then gets referred to the Attorney General's office for suspected fraud. I think so far in 2025, and I wish I had these figures in front of me, it's around 30 or 40 case referrals for suspected fraud that OIG has made to the Attorney General's office. So someone can do the math who's better than me, right, of the 1,000 or so cases we have that we're looking at any given time. We're on average referring suspected fraud, I think close to 100 cases a year. So hopefully that answers your question.
Madam Chair.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So I'd also like to know how many employees you have it at the Inspector General within DHS. How many of those employees are actually working on those 1,000 cases that are open right now? And then I would just follow that up with, which is great that we have a lower than national average of fraud or improper payments, you know, whichever category it lands in, that's still $440 million annually. And when we had the Attorney General here to that point, They were very excited to have recovered. It's approximately $10 million a year. So if we've got improper payments of $440 million a year, your number, that's your number, and we're recovering 10 on average, that's a pretty low recovery. So I'm wondering if you could, again, tell me how many employees that you have and how many of those employees are working on these 1,000 cases. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Inspector General Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Rarick. I want to be very clear, right? Improper payments does not mean fraud, right? Fraud is a crime that means that someone intentionally tried to deceive us to get money that they were not entitled to. So that for that 2.2 improper payment rate, right, the fraud rate would be less than that. So I think that might have been what the Attorney General was getting at. We have other ways to recover improper payments, right? We go through the administrative appeals process, right? So there's criminal prosecutions and recovery through restitution and recovery through False Claims Act lawsuits. That's one way to recover criminal or intentional fraud. For the unintentional kind of errors or, you know, we think of fraud, waste, and abuse, abusive practices, right, billing us without having proper documentation, billing us in a very sloppy manner, we recover money through the administrative process. So when the AG's office is saying they're only recovering, I don't know what the figure is, a certain amount of millions of dollars for fraud, we're recovering more through the administrative process than the Attorney General's office is recovering just through fraud prosecutions. The other part of your question was how many employees we have doing provider investigations. I think that number is around 30. I could get back to you with actual, a more specific, but I think it's 31. In terms of total employees at the Office of Inspector General, I think that number is around the high 300s, maybe. So I know it was 500. We split off. Our Inspector General's office split off. A lot of our employees went over to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So whatever staffing statistics that you previously had, those have been reduced now because a lot of our staff has moved to DCYF. So.
Question?
Yes, Chair Rarick, last one.
Last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that point then, so if you have 30 working on these cases, but you have just shy of 400 employees, what are the other employees doing?
Right. So I explained the core functions of the Office of Inspector General, right? So we have background studies. So a significant, we're doing 500,000 background checks a year. So a significant amount of our employees are doing background checks, right? That's an important part of program integrity, making sure that criminals and other people with disqualifying conduct do not get employment in Medicaid programs, do not get access to Medicaid funds. So that's very important, background checks. We also have a significant licensing oversight function, right? So we're responsible for ensuring that licensed programs in the state of Minnesota, they're following the laws, they're not committing maltreatment, right? So you think of the core functions of the Office of Inspector General, background studies, licensing, and provider investigations. So that's what the other employees are doing.
Thank you very much. Before we move on to my colleagues, I have a couple questions. I just wanted to jump in on following up on some of Chair Rarick's questions. First, you talked about improper payments, and I appreciate that, but I'm sure you're aware that just last month there was a GAO study talking about how there's a low rate of audited findings of improper payments with managed care organizations, but that nobody seems to be checking up on how the managed care organizations provide payments to providers. And that seems to be where the bulk of the fraud is. And at the state level and at the federal level, that doesn't seem to be happening. So could you comment on what procedures you currently have or will put in place to ensure that we're monitoring the payments between the CMOs and their providers?
Thank you, Chair Robbins. That's a very important question. And I think this is a very important point for everybody to understand about the Minnesota Medicaid program, right? 90% of the Medicaid dollars in this state are managed by managed care organizations. Again, the UCares, the Blue Crosses, Medica, Health Partners, there's others, right? So DHS, to a certain extent, is a pass-through entity, right? The money comes from taxpayers to DHS. DHS sends that money to the managed care organizations who are responsible for the care and the payments for Medicaid recipients, 90% of which get insurance through those entities. So in terms of what we are currently doing with managed care, so we have a team, it's a small team at the Office of Inspector General whose job is to provide oversight to managed care organizations and their SIU divisions. In fact, I just had a meeting with that team yesterday to talk about their work. Again, I'm fairly new to DHS, so I'm getting up to speed on what we're doing, but I think this role of managed care oversight to make sure, again, that these entities that have 90% of the Medicaid funds going to them are taking actions to suspend providers, to terminate providers, to make referrals, right, either to DHS or to the Attorney General's office. That is a very important space that I plan to look into more closely. I know we're currently doing work. We do audit managed care organizations to make sure that they're taking the actions that they're supposed to. Managed care organizations also have reporting requirements. They're supposed to report to the Department of Human Services on the fraud detection, prevention steps they are taking, and instances when they have detected fraud. So that information is reported to the Department of Human Services by the managed care organizations. But I think it's an area where we can definitely expand.
Thank you. So I would like to request that you send us whatever the most recent reports are so that we understand. I would like to know, what is the percentage of fraud in the managed care organizations that either has been self-reported or that you have identified or that CMS has identified? My understanding is CMS is doing audits themselves of the managed care organizations on a rotating basis across states. And so I don't know where Minnesota falls in that rotation, but whatever their most recent audit of Minnesota is, I couldn't find it when I was looking over the weekend, but I'd love to have that information. And then I'll move on to my colleagues, but I had one more quick question. You talked about how you recover improper payments, and the two questions are, you said through administrative recovery at DHS, you recover more than the Attorney General's office. So how much does DHS recover? And then secondly, there was a report by the OLA saying that there's $40 million in unrecovered payments that DHS just chose not to recover. And I would like you to speak to why you're leaving $40 million out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with that OLA report, so I'll have to do homework after this hearing to take a look.
We will make sure you get a copy.
And then what was the other part of your question? I'm sorry.
The other question was, you said you'd done a lot of administrative recovering of overpayments just when it wasn't fraud, but just for errors or whatever. What is a total that DHS has recovered?
And unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that question. I can definitely follow up after this hearing to get you dollar figures on administrative recoveries. So I apologize for not having that information on the top of my head. So
great. We look forward to that. Next up, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like many of us, I'm sure I have more questions than we have time to address, so I'll be selective. And I'm trying to figure out a sensitive way to address this, but we have had whistleblowers from within DHS who have approached us and have alleged that efforts to try to bring impropriety to the attention of the Inspector General or the commissioner or higher-ups within DHS has resulted in, to one degree or another, discouragement, even retaliation is a word that's been thrown around. And that obviously counters what you've said today in terms of the priority that you guys place on ensuring that these allegations are taken seriously. So my question would be, what can a frontline DHS employee expect if and when they report suspected fraudulent activity or inadequate agency function that they're observing? And either of you can speak to that.
Okay. Commissioner Gandhi.
Yeah. Chair Robbins, Representative Hudson, thank you for the question. Our frontline employees, our recipients, are our best window into things going wrong. And it is of paramount importance to me that they feel safe in reporting any concerns that they have. Now, I know that people will not always feel safe. As a former chief compliance officer and working with compliance officers around the country, there are always concerns of retaliation. That's just part and parcel of reporting concerns. So I think it's important that we have more than one avenue where people can report concerns. And like Inspector General Clark said, we will take the information from anywhere. So if an employee has concerns and they don't feel safe reporting it internally, they can share enough specific information with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They can share it with the BCA, which has expanded reporting. They can share it with you all. And as long as we have enough information to act on it, we don't need to know who said it. We just need to have enough information to act on it. Then we will investigate the matter. I think the other thing that I want to share is that I have had, since I've stepped into this role, some very brave staff who have come forward to me and shared information, sometimes anonymously and sometimes not anonymously. And in those instances where there's been enough credible information provided to me, I will take steps such as hiring an independent investigator. I don't need to know the name. I just need to get the information so we can take action.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Gandhi, for that answer. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was we received some public testimony with questions regarding your stated opposition to the OIG bill that unfortunately, from some of our perspectives, didn't get across the finish line at the end of session, despite its broad support in the Senate and a lot of conversation about it that took place throughout the session. You had a letter that was authored on March 11th where you expressed some concerns about the impact that an independent overriding statewide enterprise OIG would have on your existing operation. And some of those concerns are summarized as potentially compromised investigations by having duplicative investigations going on at the same time, concerns about your ability to maintain compliance with federal guidelines, potential loss of federal funding, and a reduced fraud handling capacity. I'm wondering if you can expound upon that, because for the folks who submitted the testimony, and I confess for myself as well, I don't quite see how those concerns mesh or at least present themselves plainly in just a basic understanding of how that new potential agency would function.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Hudson, thank you for that question. I believe I came and testified to this committee after that letter, and I am on record sharing that, I generally support program integrity measures that are going to advance integrity in Medicaid's programs, in protecting the state's taxpayer dollars, just as a general statement. What matters is how we do it and how we get there. And so I think if legislation comes forward again, we would like to work closely with you so that we can make sure that our federal requirements work. I believe that it is very important that DHS maintains an Office of Inspector General. You heard Inspector General Clark talk about the close collaboration with our program areas and how we have to knit together the program areas and the oversight to have the strongest work. And so it's important that we maintain that and we maintain our federal obligations. We do the work that's required to do, and there may be a way to also have that work together with a statewide OIG, but the details matter, and we need people that understand them more than I do, our federal relations officers, our general counsel, legal advisors, state advisors, our federal partners, to work on that together to find something that works.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'm going to follow up with that, and then I have another question. The bill that actually passed the Senate, the OIG bill, was the bill that was agreed to by at least the Republicans in the House, and then we thought the Democrats in the House. That bill kept an OIG within DHS. Did you have a chance to look at the bill that actually passed that was the final negotiated OIG bill?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Yes. I mean, our staff did look at that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my question is, do you have my understanding was that DHS was as close to they could get because they, actually being okay with that bill. Is that correct?
Commissioner Gandhi.
I honestly can't recall. I mean, okay. So I know that we were committed to working if that was going to move forward, committing to working with the legislature to get it right. How close or not it was, like, I would need to go back and check with our general counsel and federal relations experts.
Okay. Thank you. I have I will get off that. That will be back. Okay. That issue will be back. I have a question for Inspector General Clark, and welcome, and I hope that you clean up the department and do what needs to get done. So I know that a lot of the things happened before March, before your time there, and there's a lot of work that needs to get done so that we don't have all the fraud that's been happening within DHS and within Medicaid, as we're talking about that specifically, but there's other programs too. My question, so that the OIG within DHS is sending about 100 cases a year, according to you, to the Attorney General. And we have been told again by whistleblower. There's a lot of people talk to us, obviously. Some is accurate and maybe some isn't. But we've been told that there's a lot of cases that end up where the Attorney General's office needs more information. They send them back to DHS and they just die at DHS. And maybe if you can comment on that, what percent of the 100 cases that per year of fraud that go to the Attorney General's office, what percent are actually prosecuted?
Inspector General Clark.
I don't know that answer. I mean, I think that answer is better posed to the Attorney General's office. I'm here at DHS, so I don't know the exact amount that they're prosecuting each year. I want to say, now this is, could be speaking out of turn here, but I want to say, listening to when the AG's office was here, Nick Wonka, again, my prior boss, I think the number was in the 40 or so range of convictions that they got in last calendar year. But again, prosecutorial decisions, whether or not to prosecute, I mean, those are decisions that are made by the Attorney General's office. So numbers, reasons why cases are declined, reason why cases are prosecuted, I mean, I think those questions are better posed to the Attorney General's office.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Okay, thank you. So about 40% are actually get all the way. So that's give or take.
I'm a lawyer. I'm not supposed to speculate. Okay. I mean, that's to the best of my knowledge, right? But I mean, I could be way off too, though. So
okay,
I would recommend following up with the AG's office.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. And then maybe this is a better question for Commissioner Gandhi, but of those 100 cases approximately a year that are sent to the to be prosecuted or looked at, what percent are we stopping payment on? Because we have the AGs, and we've always been able to stop payment. So that was always, long before legislation this last session. But what percent, I mean, are we actually taking action? Or are we just letting this sit for a year or two and maybe it gets prosecuted if they have enough evidence?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, thank you for that question. What I can tell you is since I've been serving as temporary commissioner, that's the information that I have, and we are taking action immediately as soon as we have enough information to stop a payment, unless the law enforcement entity that we're working with asks us not to. So our default position now is to stop payment.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Okay, thank you. That's
last one.
Yeah, last one. That's good. And but what percent approximately? I mean, is it most of them that get sent to the Attorney General's office that we're actually stopping payment, or because you said if we, you know,
if they ask us not to, right?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I would just like to follow up. If you could give us a number and you can report back, but of in the last year, how many cases that have risen to the OIG's office or to the Attorney General's office have you actually stopped payment on? That would be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, we Chair Robbins, I mean, I would, the number is extremely high. We are stopping payment, percentage-wise, we are stopping payment unless the law enforcement entity says that they want us to hold off because they're gathering more evidence.
Right.
But we will
understand.
Get you the number.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate you all being back. And I know this is part of a continuous conversation. I wanted to get to this question that I think you raised that I think is important as we talk about Medicaid and how we are effectively providing the service to the Minnesotans who need it and doing it to protect those that health insurance, that health care provision, as well as public dollars. And you talked a little bit about the difference between the provider oversight, which the state does, looking at provider fraud, provider inaccurate payments, and the individual oversight of eligibility requirements, and you talked about the state versus the local, and I think that's important. Thinking about the provider piece, which you talked about, and which, frankly, this committee should be more concerned about because all of the evidence shows that's really where the concern is. That's what the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit does. Wondering, you know, we have been talking a lot in this committee, but that is dwarfed by the national conversation and the reconciliation bill that just got passed. And I'm wondering if that bill provides any help, any additional resources to do the kind of work you were talking about, both the preventative work of background and licensing and all that stuff, but more importantly, the fraud prevention of prosecutions, investigations. Is there any federal help that's coming in that bill for that, the work that the state is doing? Do you know?
Inspector General Clark.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, not that I'm aware. And so I think that question is better posed to our legislative folks who have really been following and tracking that legislation, pouring through the language. I've also reached out to the AG's office, my former colleagues, to see whether or not they were aware of any funding increases or decreases. And they're not aware either. So whether or not the federal budget is going to give us more resources, I'm just not aware. I haven't heard that that's the case, though. So.
Representative,
thank you. I appreciate that. I've been also doing a lot of reading, and that's also what I've sort of determined. So I wanted to double check that. I think that's what I heard from the AG's office as it relates to their piece of this, which is the Medicaid fraud control piece. And we actually heard lots of bills about increasing the resources for the AG's office. I think we made them take it out of the base. I think if we want to talk about that work, we should talk about, I think in the Public Safety Committee, we talked a lot about how they punch above their weight in terms of, and goes credit to you as a prosecutor there, but in terms of the work they do and how much we invest in, which is, I think, middle of the pack compared to other states. But we should talk about that because I think we've been talking about a lot of the outcomes of their work, but we need to make sure that we're investing in that piece. I did the other piece I wanted to ask about, and it actually might be more directed to, I think we have the Association of Minnesota Counties, but my understanding is the lion's share of as you talked about, the checks on eligibility and how that is working, that changes a lot under the new federal law going into effect in 2026 or 2027. And I think a lot of that in Minnesota rests on the counties. Am I right? I'm wondering if we could have the Association of Minnesota Counties come up, and I just have a question for them that's probably better suited for them than for you all.
We can have one person from the Association of Counties. We don't need everybody. We want to keep moving. Please state your name for the record, and then Representative Greenman will address the question.
Thanks, Chair Robbins, members of the committee. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. And I know I promise I won't. It's mostly from what you guys have said publicly, so won't try to delve too deeply. But my understanding, and as we talked about this, like, we're thinking about oversight. We're thinking about how to best serve how we are investing state resources into ensuring that people get access to the health care that they need and that these programs are well delivered. It's my understanding that the verification checks sit at the county with you all. I think I'm interested in how you pay for that. But let me just wrap all this question into one, which is I think it's undisputed that the issue of Medicaid fraud that we are concerned about is not an individual eligibility issue. It is a provider issue. And the individual eligibility issue, which you all handle, is also some work. My understanding, and this is, I guess, the question I have, as we're all trying to figure out these new changes that are coming down the pike, because that's our job to think about the locals too, but do you have a sense of how much additional both work and resources it's going to take to do this individual eligibility verifications, work requirement verifications? And if you think that extra resources is going to be made back by the, you know, ineligible folks you find, or the fraud as it's defined in statute that you find?
Yes.
Madam Chair and committee, county's role in the eligibility process is the individual eligibility, and so we remain committed to program integrity, both in preventing folks who are not eligible from accessing services, but also the importance of ensuring those who are eligible are able to access that. You know, the bill, reconciliation bill just passed last week, so we're still in the process of analyzing and looking at what that impact will be on counties locally in our role. Again, Minnesota is one of 10 states where counties administer Medicaid, helping with enrollment, eligibility, and the renewals. And we're one of 25 states that contribute financially to Medicaid, mostly through our targeted case management contributions. We're expecting significant cost impacts and workload impacts. I think you heard earlier from Commissioner Gandhi about some of those projections. I think we've looked back at the 2018 local fiscal note that was done on a work requirements around Medicaid bill here at the state level that projected about $160 million at that point for the local impact cost of doing that additional work requirement work for counties. In addition, we do know in the bill it includes additional verifications, particularly for Medicaid expansion populations, which will be more work for counties, and additional challenges on our existing technology system between Maxis and METS and other systems that don't inherently or aren't easily adjusted to incorporate new changes from the federal level. So we're expecting property tax burdens to counties, increased workload for the folks that are currently working on eligibility. We're concerned about the ability to add that workforce as a long-standing challenge. And we do know that other changes in the bill beyond Medicaid, they're really is intersectionality with changes to the SNAP program or food stamps in access to services like child care or cash assistance. Many of the folks who are needing economic assistance are the same folks that are intersecting with our healthcare system. And so I think there are a lot of concerns at the county level about that impact. And additionally, looking at administrative burden of changes and complexity in our system, we have a very complex eligibility system, and that creates more challenges for disqualification for folks, not because they're not inherently eligible, but because the administrative work creates a barrier or that there's an error in that process. And so making the system more complex with more steps doesn't inherently prevent fraud or
ensure that folks who aren't eligible access that information. It more often, in examples like Arkansas on 1115 waiver, disqualifies individuals who are eligible but ran into an administrative barrier.
Thank you. Last question. I think if it would be helpful, it would help if you would focus on the testimony, because this is all speculative. The bill just passed, so I would like to make sure that we're focused on the testimony of the OIG and the DHS. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that as we think about our job, as we think about oversight, as we think about going into next session, I think we have to think about the law as it will be in 2026, not the law as it will be for the next 8 months. So I think speculative is one thing. I think that there's been a ton of both debate and information, and it's helpful to hear. I don't think a fiscal note from 2018 is speculative. I think that that's the way we do our legislation. So I guess I will just, and I have lots of questions as we think about this impact on the counties, but I may leave that to my colleagues with just a statement, because I want to make sure that we are focused here on what our job is, which is ensuring that the people of Minnesota have access to health care, right, and health care provision, and that our local hospitals, our rural hospitals, can continue to provide that care, and that we are safeguarding those resources, the state dollars, the local dollars, the resources of Minnesotans that are going to pay for that. And the reason we, you know, all session tried to talk about what was happening in Congress is the reality is that we get lots of resources, or did, about this, to do this work here in Minnesota. And if those resources go away, the eligibility hasn't changed. The work requirements have. Some of the eligibility has actually changed, but we still are on the hook. So the question is, how do we pay for that? And I don't think that we, every time we brought up this reconciliation bill, trying to have this conversation, we heard it was speculative. We heard it was who knows what tomorrow will bring. Now we know what tomorrow brings. It is a giant package, which has goodies for government contractors who are going to do Equifax and other things, $20 a check, double that. It has goodies for billionaires in all sorts of places. And the way that it pays for that is by giving garbage to working class Minnesotans who don't have enough money to pay for private insurance that is going up a lot of the reasons, because we have outsourced and provided private for-profit companies access to, you know, our healthcare markets. So when I think about what our job is here, it is a giant bill. We are going to have to deal with the implications of this giant bill. Lots of goodies for wealthy people. It's going to deprive Minnesotans healthcare and coverage. And it is wrapped in red tape that's going to go to our counties, that's not going to provide better care, but it certainly will increase costs. And so I think that as we think about our job, right, that is waste, and GAO describes it as inefficiency I had it somewhere. Inefficient processes and systems. We are adding to the federal government, the Republicans' bill, is adding to that in order to kick eligible people off of health care. And that, it seems, anathema to the work of this committee and the work of us in the legislature. And so I guess what I would just ask, as we look at all of this, right, we have to focus on provider fraud. We have to focus on how do we ensure that the people who are billing the state for resources to provide these are providing the services that people need. And we have to ensure that people who are eligible for these services get them. And get them in a way that doesn't require our counties and cities to have to raise their property taxes in order to provide useless and ineffective things. So I think that this has been really helpful. I think as we talk about this going forward, I do think we're going to have to think about both what's happening at the county level and what's happening at the state level and how we as a state are investing in it. But I hope we think about our systems not just from the perspective of the myopic view of what we have decided, because frankly, we don't have control over what the Republican big, terrible bill did. But we will have to deal with the impact of that as it relates to Minnesotans, working class Minnesotans, rural hospitals, and frankly, the taxpayer dollars at the local level that are going to go up. So that I will leave my questions there and leave it to other people. But we have our work cut out in front of us, and it is not a an assignment that we asked for, but it certainly is something that we're going to have to make sure that we protect Minnesotans and their health care from, and we ensure that people know who is cutting them off of health care.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the Commissioner. Thank you to the counties as well. I appreciated the insight today, and the thing that I'm really deciphering here amidst all of the testimony is the impacts that was just discussed by Representative Greenman, and I appreciate her perspective. But let's level set here a little bit. Okay, so we've been talking about the amount of money of Medicaid dollars that are spent in Minnesota. Let's compare ourselves to similar size states. $20 billion is spent on Medicaid in Minnesota on an annual basis, as was provided by the people at the desk from the Department of Human Services. By comparison, two larger states, Colorado and Wisconsin, both spend approximately $13 billion in Medicaid spending. How is it that Minnesota provides $7 billion more than those states that are larger than us? I think that's an open question for us. And then let's also talk about what the commissioner just said the bill from Washington is going to do to changes in Minnesota. She said that there's going to be $500 million of costs per year, and that 150,000 to 250,000 people will be removed. Okay? That still is what? $6.5 billion more of benefits provided than states of similar size to us. So my question is, who are these people that are receiving $7 billion more than states that are larger than us? And let's start there.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, thank you for that question. In Minnesota, the majority of Medicaid spending is for older adults and people with disabilities. While they make up 14% of the population, the spending for them is about 60%. So one of the things that we have been proud of in Minnesota is the quality of life for people with disabilities that we are able to afford. We have waivers in place that allow people to live in community and to thrive. And if you look at our rankings across the country, we are at the top by a far margin. So in terms of spending, that's where the largest amount of dollars go.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it really hard to believe, and I believe there's actually direct data that contradicts what you just said, that there aren't people with disabilities or seniors that live in those same states, Wisconsin and Colorado, larger size states than we are here in Minnesota. So I appreciate this. It's going to be a question about the state budget. It's going to be a question of our values, how we talk about supporting the dignity of work. It's going to be having that conversation about who is eligible. So in Minnesota, how does one qualify for Medicaid that has been so much more generous than states around us?
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I went over the eligibility requirements. I'm not sure of the question.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, certainly I'm expecting that if there's such a huge amount more that we're spending in Medicaid, that there are Minnesotans that are qualifying that wouldn't in other states. What are those eligibility requirements that provide more assistance to people who aren't eligible for the same benefits in other states?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I don't have a crosswalk between the two states you mentioned and our eligibility requirements.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Well, at the end of the day here, what Republicans are championing is this idea that there's a dignity of work. And if you're an able-bodied adult, that you should be contributing to our economy. And we have huge opportunities for jobs across the state to make great wages, to get jobs with employers who have health insurance. And the bill that just passed in Washington is all about ensuring that able-bodied adults, people who look just like me, and many of us around this table, that they're contributing to our society. So we need to take a look in Minnesota, because somehow there's $6.5 billion that could be going to help support counties as they administer this program. And even if we just use your number, Commissioner, it would be $500 million that could go to help support those counties as they do the work. So it seems like there's plenty of money for us to discuss around this as we seek to make sure that we're building a culture of work, and so that we aren't having the same programs and the program issues that we've seen here in Minnesota with huge fraud. Because it was the governor who said earlier this year that it's probably a culture of generosity. I think it's a culture of being a little bit too trusting on this. Those were his words. So I guess my final question for you, Commissioner, what have you done since the governor uttered these words to change the culture within your agency so that we're not seeing the levels of fraud that we have seen in Minnesota?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, in the few months that I have been temporary commissioner, I have been working closely with the members of the Office Inspector General. I have been collaborating with the Department of Public Safety, the Bureau of Criminal Affairs, and looking to strengthen wherever possible. So a couple specific actions would be that in March, I designated a couple services, EIDBI and Housing Stabilization Services, as high risk. In the Medicaid program, agencies have the authority to do that. That went into effect June 1st, and that put into place additional oversight requirements in these unlicensed programs. We now have background checks of owners. We have the ability to do site visits and revalidation more frequently. In addition, DHS worked very closely with the Walz-Flanagan administration and had many program integrity measures in the governor's bill that we advocated for. The legislature passed many of them, and many of you supported those measures.
Thank you. All right. I know we have two more questions, but I had a quick question. So I think part of the question of how we compare vis-a-vis other states is that we have what we call the expanse in population, which is adults between 19 and 64 who are able-bodied. We've become an expansion state to take that on. But we also have an expansion of programs that other states don't have. Those are the optional benefits. And so I'm not going to ask for you to provide it right now, but what I would like to know is what are the optional benefits outside of traditional Medicaid that Minnesota has signed on to? Because that's where the fraud seems to be, and I want to get back to that. It seems to be in some of the programs you've already identified as high risk, housing stabilization, sober homes, autism centers, peer-to-peer recovery, non-emergency medical transportation, in those things which are optional benefits that other states don't have necessarily, that seems to be where the bulk of the fraud is and a bulk of the cost. So if you could just get back to me with what are the optional benefits Minnesota has adopted versus traditional Medicaid, acute, and primary care, and also the expansion population. How many more people did that add to the roles when we took that on? My understanding, which I have from the Department of Medicaid, CMS in DC, is that we have 318,000 Minnesotans in our expansion population, which is way more than we have in our other adult, which is caretaker, pregnant, parent, disabled, or elderly. So 318 people who are the able-bodied 19 to 64 who will now have work requirements, and that those people get a higher benefit than the national average. They get $10,713 per person, and the national average, according to CMS, is $7,569. So that's at least a place where we are over-indexing. And because the incentive on the expansion population is to enroll people there, because the feds prior to this bill were picking up 90% of the tab, we were pushing people into that expansion population, which is also where the higher benefit amount is. So for, please get back to me with those numbers, because that's the crux of what we need to be talking about here. We need to find out where the fraud is. We need to find out where our benefits are more generous, perhaps, than other states. And we need to figure out how we can make these programs affordable so that the people who really need it, the disabled, the elderly, pregnant moms, parents, children under age 14, those are the traditional Medicaid population and are most vulnerable that we need to continue to serve. So that is my request. And now we'll go on to Representative Elkins. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two lines of questioning. I'll try and keep them brief.
Thank you.
But the first one, we talked earlier about how 90% of our Medicare patients are covered under managed care organizations. So I'm not sure which of you would want to field this, but my understanding is that for the MCO managed patients, we're reimbursing the carriers on a capitated basis, are we not?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, that's correct.
Yeah. So under this arrangement, if there is fraud, if there are fraudulent claims in that part of the market and the carrier pays them, it comes out of their pockets, not the taxpayers' pockets, right?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, correct.
Yeah, so in 90% of our market, the taxpayers are not, liable for any fraudulent claims that are paid, which is consistent with all of the reading that I've done that says that fraud is much more prevalent in fee-for-service programs than it is in managed care programs. So that's the one line. The other line I've been thinking as I was listening to the earlier testimony is that, clearly one of the things that's happening here is that both the OIG and the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Unit are having to choose which claims to pursue given limited staffing. And so the economist in me tells me that you would pursue the claims with the biggest reward. And forego pursuing the claims with the smallest reward. And again, the economist to me says that, okay, that there should be a framework here by which, the OIG and the Attorney General's office ought to be able to estimate for us what would be an optimal staffing level that would maximize the net returns from enforcement. And then that ought to be the basis for a supplemental budget request from the administration to staff both of those offices at the optimal level. Maybe Mr. Clark could comment on that.
Inspector General Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I think the point that I'd like to make is fighting fraud takes resources.
Yep.
It's a daunting task. I thought coming over from the AG's office to DHS, thinking that I was going to be at least partially in charge of integrity of a $20 billion Medicaid program, right? That's a heavy ask. There's lots of money. We have 300,000 Medicaid providers in this state.
Yeah.
The AG's office only has a limited number of prosecutors. OIG has a limited number of investigators. Detecting, preventing fraud, fighting fraud takes resources. We're doing what we can with the resources we have, and I think we're doing a good job. Like I said, we're doing our own data analytics. We're leveraging the private sector on data analytics and audits. We're doing the same stuff in-house. We're also leveraging and heavily relying, like you said, on managed care organizations who are responsible for 90% of Medicaid dollars in this state to do their fair share. But yeah, when you're talking about an office that's tasked with overseeing the integrity of $20 billion, it's difficult. And I think we would welcome more resources. Again, I've been there 3 months, but you know, maybe the commissioner has a better idea to kind of resource ideas, but whether it's technology investments, investigator investments, you know, I'd welcome it all.
Representative Elkins.
Just kind of closing comment then. I mean, I think it seems reasonable to me that in a fiscal note for requested additional resources that it ought to be possible as part of the fiscal note calculations to estimate both the additional costs and the additional recovered revenues that would be achieved by increasing the staffing in both of those offices. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pinto. Chair Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. A few things, and I'll try to keep things focused as usual. First question is, I think for somebody at DHS regarding work requirements, that's been brought up a number of times. And just, I don't know if there's somebody who could comment on the impact of them, kind of what the data and evidence shows. Looks like gentleman coming up. And if you could just talk about the impact in terms of we obviously want to make sure that folks are working and have the dignity of work, and if you can talk about the impact of work requirements.
Please state your name for the record.
John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Chair Robbins, Chair Pinto. So the initial estimates from the Kaiser Family Foundation are that about 150,000 to 250,000 Minnesotans may lose their coverage through Medicaid. And that is an estimate that we have right now as a result of work requirements, as the commissioner said.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Connolly, if you could, Commissioner Connolly, if you could just talk about kind of what the evidence shows, like basically imposing work requirements, is the impact generally positive, and that in fact more people are working and they're not losing coverage, we're sort of, it's reducing fraud. I have a sense, I guess I'll say, that often the impact ends up being negative, that people who are otherwise eligible and are in fact working end up getting kicked off health coverage because of a lot of paperwork and various things they have to do. But if you could just talk about sort of the impact of work requirements.
Mr. Connolly.
Chair Robbins and Chair Pinto. So a couple of things about that. So first of all, we know that based on data nationally and also about Minnesota, that roughly two-thirds of people in the Medicaid program work if they are of working age. And those that don't, the vast majority of that group, have a reason, a disability. They are caretakers. They're in school, chronic conditions. So they have a reason. A small share of the remainder that aren't working would kind of be incentivized to find work. But it's a very small share, less than 10%. So the vast majority of people in the program are presently working or have a reason that would exempt them from working as a result, or rather under the federal bill that just passed. In addition, the vast body of research about this also in Medicaid demonstrates that people who lose coverage as a result of a work requirement or redeterminations, more frequent redeterminations, typically are eligible. So there is kind of a marginal reduction every time you add an administrative requirement or a paperwork requirement with respect to eligibility in terms of reduction in enrollment.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you. Yes, Chair Pinto.
Thank you,
I just want to note for the record that we are going to go a little bit longer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Maybe I will, maybe actually for Commissioner Connolly as well, this difference between Minnesota spending some more than other states, my understanding is that at least a portion of that is that we have rates that are closer to private pay rates. When I'm thinking about our nursing homes, we're so dependent on these funds, and I think there'd be folks who would lose, who will lose coverage as a result of the budget that just passed, the federal budget. Can you just talk about, is part of the difference between our state and other states is that we pay somewhat higher rates that are closer to what private individuals would pay, and therefore keep our nursing homes and other organizations afloat?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins and Chair Pinto, so there are a variety of reasons for the per capita spending being what it is in Minnesota. I think, as the commissioner said, the majority of our spending is on older adults and people with disabilities. We do have a more comprehensive set of benefits, either through waivers or more generally in the program in our state plan, both for seniors and people with disabilities, but also for the expansion group. So that has been a historic investment Minnesota has made in its Medicaid program and the health care provided to its people. And that is probably the largest driver in terms of per capita spending being different than other states. But it's also true that for behavioral health service providers, I think we in Minnesota are proud that we do pay generally a more competitive rate for mental health and substance use disorders, as an example. And nursing homes, due to kind of legal structures here in Minnesota, also often, you know, nursing homes that accept Medicaid receive reimbursement at the same rate from other payers. So that's just another kind of feature of the Medicaid program and our statutes here in Minnesota. But it's a complex set of reasons why we have higher per capita spending, but in general it's because of investment in benefits and provider payment.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I don't need you any further, Deputy Commissioner Conley, but thank you so much for your comments. I appreciate it. Chair, and this is a little bit delicate. I was going to leap in a lot earlier, and there was a question from the other side. And so and it was from Vice Chair Anderson, whom I respect greatly, but she had made a comment to the Inspector General about the need to, quote, clean up the department, mm-hmm. and reference all, quote, all the fraud within DHS. And I know we often have a lot of rhetoric back and forth. What concerned me was that we had the commissioner right here. And so I just wondered if I'm certainly aware that there is that there are fraud. There's fraud, frankly, whenever there's human endeavors, right, when there's funds. And we're so lucky to have Inspector General Clark and the commissioner and others doing this work. I'm not aware of fraud, quote, within DHS. That may have been, Vice Chair Anderson may not have meant that in exactly that way. But I just wanted to make sure the commissioner had a chance, because there have been some comments about the agency that I see a lot. I've got a lot of concerns myself with DHS various times through the years. But boy, I see people working really, really hard to serve the people of Minnesota. I wasn't sure if she wanted to say something in response to those comments, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Gandy.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, thank you for that opportunity. Yeah, I am not aware of fraud within DHS recently. I know there were situations many years ago, isolated, but I am not aware of any fraud within DHS staff.
Okay. Thank you. And then finally, Chair, if I can.
Yes.
And then final comment. I'll just say I really am glad that we've had this understanding of we've heard from counties about them overseeing eligibility of individuals in Medicaid, which they do, and heard from the agency regarding eligibility for providers. There are certainly concerns in that area. And I'm also glad the way the questioning has gone and raised by a number of my GOP colleagues about this program, the impact of the budget just been passed by President Trump and congressional Republicans, the importance of the program to Minnesotans, the fact that several hundred thousand Minnesotans will lose coverage. It may be, in fact, I sort of got the sense in these questions that rolling back some of those benefits is the goal to a certain extent. I heard some of the reasons that folks may have that. I think we do need to recognize, though, that we are in a situation where when we think about Medicaid eligibility, what we're thinking about is people losing that eligibility, in part for reasons that may be fair, but often for reasons unfair, and people who are eligible for Medicaid, but who will in fact not receive the health care that they need and that they deserve because of these requirements and restrictions have gone into place. And that, according to our health care providers in our state, will have a rolling out of costs on all of us. This is from Essentia Health, saying that cost will be shifted to the rest of us, everybody else in this room, whether it's commercial insurance people that are paying for their health care out of pocket, all the money that used to come from Medicaid to pay for people's needs, because if they don't get coverage, health care in general, they're going to be going to the emergency room and causing our hospitals to go bankrupt, and those nursing homes as well that I know are so important to so many of us. So I'm glad we've had the chance to talk about this, and Medicaid, I think, should continue to be top of mind for all of us. And thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to have this conversation.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Last very short question from Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to talk really quickly too about SSIS, and I know that's been a huge, the computer program, the database, that's been a huge problem. And I went to a presentation in one of the counties, and 70% of a worker's time, frontline worker, was putting data into SSIS, and how cumbersome, and, you know, this is a blue screen and it's ancient, back from the late 80s, I believe it was, or maybe early 90s it was developed. So can you imagine how much more time these frontline workers would have if they didn't spend 70% of their time putting in data into an ancient, failing SSIS state program that we, the state, forced them to use. So we finally have given some money to try to get that fixed. We should have done that decades ago. It's absolutely ancient, and I'm surprised Representative Elkins didn't talk more about that, because he's kind of our data guy over there. But that is significant. I think we need to talk about how impactful and cumbersome our state of Minnesota outdated programs are. It puts so much burden on the county, so much burden on the frontline workers, both at the state and at the county. So, again, 70% of a frontline worker's time at the county is spent putting data into this archaic system that doesn't work. And half the time they get the circle of death. So, they sit there and they wait and wait and wait and wait and wait for this thing to load, or it fails altogether or whatever. So we need to fix that. We finally put some money towards fixing that. So that's one. Two, when you talk about the new adults, so these are not disabled, these are not children, these are not elderly, they are a new expansion group of 318,000 new people, costing the state of Minnesota $3.2 billion. $3.2 billion. These are not disabled, these are not children, they are not aged, they are not elderly. They are able-bodied people that could work. Again, $3.2 billion more per year. So we have to talk about that as well. That is a huge expansion.
Do you have a question? Sorry.
Yeah, so the last thing the question is, I've been talking to whistleblowers nonstop, as I've talked about in this committee, the entire time. And Representative Hudson touched on it, but I am incredibly concerned about our frontline workers. I am incredibly concerned about the people that are trying to cut off fraud. And what they are telling me is that DHS themselves are surveilling through programs and whatever the employees, looking for keywords. Like, are you talking about fraud? Are you talking about waste? Are you talking about whatever? That's what the whistleblowers are telling me, that they are being surveilled. And when they reach out and they step out and say, hey, I see something wrong here, I see something wrong there, they are retaliated against. Their jobs are threatened. Their livelihoods are threatened. Their families are threatened. So I am incredibly concerned with what the whistleblowers continue to talk to me about. And it has been over months and months and months of talking to whistleblowers within DHS. These are frontline workers within DHS. So, Madam Chair, I am so incredibly concerned about that. I know you heard them say that. I know Representative Hudson has heard them say that. I know Representative Anderson has heard them say that. So I am going to leave it with that, that nothing will change. It doesn't matter what laws we pass. It doesn't matter how much money we invest. If we are threatening our frontline workers and we are giving them antiquated equipment to work with that doesn't work, and it sits, they have spent over 70% of their time working in a database that doesn't work. So those two factors alone are inexcusable and should never happen, and we should have fixed it a long time ago. And I hope that with the new commissioner, we are not going to be surveilling our staff or the DHS workers, the frontline workers, and we are not going to be threatening them anymore, because that has got to stop. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Gandhi, are you aware of surveilling the workers, and do you have any other additional comments?
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, thank you for those comments and questions. DHS does not surveil its employees. We have what I will share with you, and happy to meet with you in your office separately, but when we get complaints, employee complaints of wrongdoing, if our investigation requires us to look at employee emails to understand what's happening, We have a process in place whereby that has to be requested, that information is kept, and so there is a record of any time that we do that and the words we were looking for. We are not looking for whistleblowers. Retaliation is not acceptable in any form. I will stand by that every single day, and I would be happy to share with you the types of things that we're looking for in employee investigations when we do look at emails. Emails, phone calls, text messages on government property is government data. It is not the personal property of the staff. That's true of most businesses where you work. So we are not surveilling our employees to do what you suggest. And again, like I shared earlier, if people are concerned, I will take the specific information without the name of the individual. I don't need the name of the individual to act. So we will take action on any information that we receive, whether it comes from an employee or not, with a name or not. Secondly, I want to just thank you for your comments about the SSIS system. When the children, youth, and family was part of DHS, and I toured the state and visited counties and tribal nations, I got to see the very same green screens that you're talking about. I heard about the amount of minutes county workers spend with downtime. It is a system that the state should have invested in upgrading a long time ago. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm very thankful that the legislature put money forward and that now DCYF and Minute are working on together with the counties on addressing the systems. And I also agree with what the Association of Minnesota Counties and MACSA has told us in terms of our other aging systems that need investments to make the workers' lives easier and more efficient and effective. And that will also help DHS to implement policy changes that happen all the time at the state and federal level more nimbly and quickly. Right now, it's very cumbersome and time-consuming and staff-intensive to make systems changes. So I agree with you on that and look forward to further investments there.
Thank you. So I just was reminded of one question I had from actually my freshman year. When I served on the HHS committee, I have not served on it since my freshman term, but there was a controversy or an issue, about making sure that there were data matching reports provided to the legislature. And that was paused during COVID, but my understanding is that has not picked back up. So could you give me sort of a status report on providing data matching reports to the legislature and when we can expect that?
Chair Robbins, do you have that answer? Okay, I don't have that answer.
Thank you, Mr. Conley.
Does.
Yeah, so we can look into providing the specific data to you and the committee. However, periodic data matching has resumed, and I believe it resumed at the end of the unwinding in 2024.
And have those reports been, have you then reported on the status of that to the legislature, to the, say, the committees of jurisdiction?
I'd have to verify that, but okay. We can provide that information.
Great, thank you, because that was a big concern, you know, back in 2019, and I just wanted to make sure that we're continuing to follow that, because that's part of the thread of understanding eligibility. So thank you. Members, it has been a robust hearing. Commissioner, Inspector General, Mr. Conley, other members of the public, thank you for being here. We are adjourned.